Welcome back to Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. I'm your host, Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. Give us a call at 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397 if you have a question for Governor Bob McDonnell. Governor, every summer at Sorensen, we have a couple of programs that bring college students and high school students from all over Virginia to the University of Virginia for an experience. The college students stay with us in a dorm at UVA for a month, and all of them come up with projects for the Virginia General Assembly to consider as legislation. You signed one of the bills that was developed in last year's College Leaders Program. This year, two bills have been put in, and the college leaders have come up with a bill sponsored by Republican Delegate Ed Scott of Madison and Democratic Senator Cree Deeds of Bath, and the bill would promote honeybee production and agriculture that honeybees are necessary adjuncts for in Virginia. So the bill would give a $200 tax credit per new beehive for beekeepers across Virginia. Any thoughts?
Well, first, I'm delighted to see the young people participating in Sorensen Institute involved directly in the political process. I appreciate the work that you're doing there, and over my many years in office, being able to speak to some of these young future leaders has been tremendous. I haven't looked at that bill. From what little I know about the incredible role that bees play in pollination and crop development, I think, and the fact that it is a vitally important part of our overall agriculture mix, I'd certainly be open to supporting a tax credit. I haven't seen the specifics of that. Obviously, we always have questions with both affordability and the sustainabilities of the policy, but I know every year I expect several tax credit bills to reach my desk. I'm supporting several that I've actually taken a look at, but yeah, we'll certainly take a look at that. It doesn't sound like it's a lot of money, but it does sound like it's a good purpose.
And it would be capped at $2,400 per beekeeper, so you have to be a beekeeper registered with the State Department of Agriculture.
We'll take a look at that.
Very good. Let's get back to our callers. Our next caller is John in Salem. John, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Thank you. Good evening, gentlemen. Governor, I listened with interest to your comments about the advisability of evaluating teachers the same way as people in private industry are evaluated, but I would like you to consider one major difference between the teaching environment and private industry. In private industry, if I have people working under me who I'm responsible for, I can fire or remove those people if they don't perform. If my evaluation is based on their performance, I can do something about their performance if it's substandard. Teachers don't always have that option. Teachers can't fire problem students. Teachers can't remove underperforming students from their classrooms. There are simply limits to what teachers can do. You mentioned earlier that the ideal situation is concerned teachers, concerned parents working together. I have to tell you that there are a lot of parents out there who aren't concerned and a lot of students who, no matter what a teacher will do, simply refuse to become involved in the learning process. So I think that should be taken into account when you consider evaluating teachers. That's my only comment. Thank you all.
Well, it's a good comment that the nature of a teaching job is particularly tough in the modern environment. We ask teachers to do a lot more than they did 20, 30 years ago, given some of the dynamics of family or the lack of family support, the many challenges that young people are facing in the society with the unfortunate realities of drugs and gangs and so forth. But I will say that it's not only looking at teachers vis-a-vis the private sector, but also other parts of state employment. We don't make those kind of guarantees, essentially in perpetuity, for other people in state government to have a continuing contract. Secondly, I would say that the teachers would not be evaluated solely based on the performance of their students. Now, I think it is a material element to look at in these evaluations, to look at the increase in the performance of the students. Because you make a point that the teacher has to accept the class that they that they are assigned. But there are many, many other factors that go into these teacher evaluations, with everything from in classroom evaluations by the principal to preparation to timeliness to any number of these other factors. So students themselves are only one factor. We've also passed last year a merit pay pilot program that is in place now to really try to fine-tune what a merit pay and a good evaluation system would be like for teachers. But it just goes back to this basic idea that whether it's the public or private sector, that people who are rewarded for performance, who are given good feedback and reviews and opportunity for corrective action, perform better. But if you have guarantees and not a lot of accountability, it can create challenges. So listen, it's just one more tool that I think our principals and our superintendents will have to make sure they can truly bring in the best and the brightest men and women into the teaching fold.
Thank you, John. Thanks for your call and your question. Our next caller is Elizabeth in Richmond. Elizabeth, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Thank you. Thank you, Governor. I'm a little nervous, but I have a question, sir, regarding the possible joining of the Department of Correctional Education and the Department of Corrections. My question to begin would be, was this something that you had originally planned when you came into office? And if it's so, well, let me change that. Or was it something that was truly come up by the Reform Committee? My second part of my question is, do you believe that the Department of Correctional Education has done a good job or a decent job with reducing recidivism? And if that is the case, is it going to be worth the risk of increasing recidivism for a savings of $1 million a year? That would be my
Elizabeth,
question.
You didn't sound nervous at all. You ask a great question. Thank you.
Thank you.
For calling in. Let me say that government reform has been a top priority for me these last couple of years. I signed an executive order the day I took office. Which was 2 years ago yesterday, I might add, to put together a commission on government reform. And listen, it's just common sense to take a look at every element of government to find out what can you do better, smarter, quicker, more efficient, more cheaply, if you will, for our constituents. And over this last year, our government reform commission came up with a number of ideas to consolidate and eliminate boards and commissions and agencies and departments so that we can cut down on duplication, cut down on overhead, and just get things working a little bit better. So, yes, they came up with this idea. It wasn't something that I ran on nor that I had in my mind directly when we came into office to combine Department of Corrections and the Department of Correctional Education. It's one of the ideas they've come up with. I do support that. I think we can do it under one umbrella. We're doing okay with recidivism. Our recidivism rate is certainly below the national average, but with our prisoner reentry efforts that I've launched and staff that I brought in and programs we've put in place, we think we can do an awful lot of things better through the Department of Corrections to make sure that every prisoner is prepared to get out and that they've got a good individual plan on everything from transportation, housing, jobs, et cetera, to give them every chance of success. We want these people, when they get out, to be law-abiding citizens, contributing members of society, and not return to prison. So while DCE has done an okay job and a good job in some areas, I think we can do better, and I think we can do it more effectively with this consolidation.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Thanks for your call and your question. Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest on Assembly Conversations this evening. Give us a call if you would like to ask him a question. 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. Governor, what do you think of the 200-plus pardons that were issued recently by outgoing Governor Haley Barbour in Mississippi?
Well, most governors, I think, issue the bulk of their pardons on their way out the door. I haven't looked at really any of those pardons. Every governor's got this general grant of authority under the Constitution to grant pardons. It's a unique power. There are virtually no standards in the code or the Constitution on how to exercise it. It's really to essentially effectuate or meet the ends of justice. Now, Governor Barbour looked at those cases and obviously felt that for whatever reason those were the right things to do. I'm obviously concerned that some of those pardons were for people that have been accused or been convicted, excuse me, of very violent crimes. why he chose to do that. I honestly, Bob, I've only read the headlines. I can just say that in Virginia, we are granting a lot of people the restoration of their civil rights when they get out so they can get back to work and vote and participate in society. I've granted very, very few pardons because a pardon really says we almost pretend that a criminal conviction doesn't exist. That's the illegal effect of that. So I think they ought to be used very sparingly. Governor Barbour obviously had a little bit different view, but I can't pass judgment from 1,000 miles away on each of those individual cases. I just don't know the facts.
Did you watch the debate in the presidential field in the Republican contest last night down in South Carolina? And did you have any opinion of the question that Rick Santorum asked of another governor in that field, Governor Mitt Romney, about whether pardons should be issued to people, whether voting rights should be restored, whether rights should be restored to felons?
I did watch most of the debate, although I have to admit I snuck away in the second half a little bit to watch the Notre Dame basketball game. I'm sorry, we've got to have our priorities. Actually, there are more Republican debates than there are Notre Dame basketball games on TV. So
that's true. There've been 16 so far.
But anyway, having said all that, I did not see that exchange. I did see some comments afterwards where it seems like the two of them disagreed on whether people ought to have their civil rights restored. And I've already made my my case clear that in the majority of cases, when people have paid their debt to society, when they've had a waiting period after they've been released from probation or parole, and they've clearly shown that they want to be contributing members of society, we ought to give them a second chance. I mean, we are a nation of second chances. Everyone's made mistakes. Everyone should get a chance to do what's right, because our goal is keeping people working and employed and taking care of their families and responsible, not going back to prison. And I've granted a very high number of people getting their civil rights back. So I'm not sure all the differences between the two the two candidates on that, but I think that's
the right question thing. Involved a super PAC that was attacking Santorum for a bill he'd voted for that restored rights. And Santorum was responding to Romney that in Massachusetts, when he was governor, even violent felons who were out on probation and parole could still vote. Why didn't you, Santorum, ask the governor, do away with that or try to do away with that law?
I didn't hear all that colloquy, but I think we're at the stage of the debate where people are trying to make the fine points of difference, because all of the big issues have been debated and rehashed and debated some more over the last 6 months. And so I think people are looking, especially right on the eve of primaries, to make those final decisions. But look, and on the big issues, all I can say is every one of those five people on the stage, I think, would do a better job leading this nation than our current president when it comes to everything from taxes to spending to energy to jobs to protecting the military. Every one of those five would do a better job. So I'm not as worried about smaller differences on criminal justice policy. I'm concerned about the financial integrity and the job creation capacity of America.
Do you have a favorite you'd rather run with as a vice presidential running mate?
Would you stop those rumors here, Bob? I'm convinced you started that. No, I'm neutral at this point, but I just want to win. And I want the most electable conservative candidate to be our nominee. I've said for quite some time, and again, I'm biased, but I think that the skill set that's missing in Washington is somebody who can balance a budget, create jobs, talk straight, don't make excuses, bring people together and get things done. That's what governors do. So I'm partial to a current or former governor. We're down to now two after Governor Huntsman's exit, but I'm going to continue to watch this over the next weeks and see what happens.
Let's get back to our callers. Our next caller is Scott in Crozet. Scott, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Hi, that's great. Thanks.
Hi, Scott.
I wanted to know how you felt about the Attorney General's decision to run even after his agreement with Mr. Bowling. And also, I was wondering if George Allen spoke with you about his run for Senate only 4 years after his little macaca gate episode.
Hey, Scott, thanks for calling. I appreciate you calling from beautiful Crozet. Passed there quite a bit going to places like Wintergreen. It's a beautiful part of our state. Listen, it's a free country. If people feel called to run for office and think they can bring something to the public square and have a lot of good ideas and have a heart to serve, then I'd say you can run. Now, I told Lieutenant Governor Bowling 3.5 years ago that I would support him. We ran together as candidates for governor and lieutenant governor starting in the middle of 2008. He has been a great partner with me on creating jobs and managing the state day to day. And so I've committed to support the lieutenant governor. You know, the attorney general is my lawyer. We work closely together on a number of things, and he's doing a good job giving me good advice. So listen, that's completely up to the parties about what they want to do. With regard to George Allen, I can tell you I'm supporting George Allen. He did lose the election back in 2006, but I've worked with the governor and the senator over the last 20 years. I think he's probably been perhaps the most successful reform governor of the modern era with his major reforms like parole abolition, welfare reform, education reform, all major things that are still benefiting Virginians today. I think he did a responsible job in the U.S. Senate, and so I think he's the right guy for the job.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for your call and your question. Governor Bob McDonnell is my guest on Assembly Conversations. Give us a call if you would like to ask a question of the governor. 866-611-NEWS. That's 866-611-6397. Our next caller is Will in Floyd. Will, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with the governor.
Thanks. My question has to do with secondary education in the Commonwealth. Currently, a student needs 22 credits to receive a standard diploma and 26 to receive an advanced diploma. And as the governor may know, many of the school systems in the state are on the block schedule, and students can take up to 8 credits a year. And I just wanted to get his input on the possibility of students being eligible to graduate in 3 years with parental permission. I feel like this would give parents more options and students more options, as well as saving the Commonwealth a lot of money.
Hey, I'm all for it. That's the kind of innovative reforms that we are proposing this session. We're trying to get those 7 degrees down to 3. Three different types of diplomas and up the level of rigor with those diplomas. We have promoted dual enrollment in this budget in our education reform policy. So if young people want to be enrolled in both high school and in a community college at the same time, which a number of them do, we want to promote that and accelerate that, get people out of high school faster, get them into college and out faster if they're capable of doing that and they're motivated and smart enough to do that. I think we're absolutely for that. So you're going to see, you have seen already with our rollout last week, a number of innovative ideas to improve K-12. We talked about a couple of those already with the teacher tenure reform bill, tuition tax credits, more legislation to expand the availability of charter schools and virtual schools, of heavy emphasis on third grade reading and not having social promotion. If young people can't read, that gives a disservice to them. And a number of other things that'll improve the outcomes of our young people, and a focus on STEM. You know, we got to start thinking at a young age about getting people into the career fields that'll create the good jobs in science, technology, engineering, math, healthcare. Those are some of those areas. So I appreciate the reforms you've advocated, and we have a lot more we're going to be after this session.
Thank you, Will. Thanks for your call and your question. Our next caller is Jason in Galax. Jason, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Hi. My wife and I are both college educated. And
hi, Jason.
Hi. It's really great that you're on the program tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
What I was curious about, I work in Blacksburg, Virginia, and I hear stories all the time that make me think that the focus of the university system in Virginia is not necessarily on educating students, but on attracting research grants and on attracting other government funding. And the budgets never seem to decrease or never seem to hit an even keel, but tuitions continually increase. And I was wondering if there was any focus at the state level to try to stem some of that cost in and focus a little more on educating students
Well, Jason, thanks for calling from the home of the Fiddlers Convention. The Galax is a great place. Listen, we've made higher education reform and reinvestment and restructuring a huge priority this last 2 years. Last year, we had a landmark bill that passed amazingly with unanimous support. Every one of the 140 legislators voted for it. It set some new goals and new measurements for outcomes in our university. This year, I've recommended about $230 million of new funding and putting that money into things like degree completion and financial aid and use of technology and cooperative partnerships and more students getting into our universities, but some of it into research and development, because I think practical outcomes in our R&D, university-based research is important. I would say that actually, you know, compared to most states, Virginia actually ranks fairly low in the dollars that go into university-based research, but particularly in Virginia Tech, and which does the best in the state, and that's why maybe you're seeing it in Blacksburg, we have a lot of businesses, in fact, about 150 of them, I think, that have sprung up in that research park around Virginia Tech because of the academic research that's gone on there that have turned into practical solutions and real jobs. So we are trying to balance the lion's share of the money that we're recommending for increase this year into these practical goals like STEM education and degree completion and financial aid and so forth. But at least some of it's going to go into common sense, results-oriented research and development that'll actually lead to real progress and real jobs.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for calling your question. Our next caller is Bill back in Roanoke. Bill, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Bill.
First, I'd like to say that I appreciate your comments on safety first when it comes to uranium mining, particularly with respect to groundwater.
Yes.
You commented earlier about fracking, though, and said that it was a technology that's been around for a long time. My understanding of the controversy with fracking is that the controversy is with a new technology where the pressure is exerted laterally underground rather than vertically, and that it affects much larger land areas, and that, of course, it's not just water. It's water with chemical mix that the companies
right.
that do the fracking are very reluctant to disclose. And also, since it's very new technology, my understanding is the jury is very much still out on the safety with respect to groundwater. And that in recent weeks I've heard stories in the news about that the technology is being looked at as a possible cause of earthquakes. I'm wondering if you're familiar with the difference between the new and old fracking, and if you'd comment on what your understanding of the safety.
Yeah, well, thank you for the call. And you are correct that it used to be solely a vertical fracking, meaning that the well shaft was just straight down, and the drill would just go straight down, maybe through an aquifer, and then into the areas where the discharge of water, and you're correct, other chemicals was made to be able to release the gas. But now, with this phenomenal new technologies, not only can you drill straight down, but you can then drill horizontally or even diagonally, both underwater, but particularly on land. And so you're right, that is a newer technology. My point is, in the areas that it's been done, particularly in Pennsylvania and some other places like that now for at least some time, there's not been evidence of groundwater contamination that I have seen. It is a factor that is looked at in the permitting process before these permits are given to be sure that to the degree that the drilling, whether it's vertical or horizontal, is going to traverse an aquifer, meaning an underground water storage area, that all the safety precautions are in place so that none of the chemicals nor the natural gas or other things from underground actually leach into the groundwater supply. So I think that the regulatory process is in place. And so, at least from what I have seen in Virginia, we're confident that both all processes for fracking are safe. And they've been going on, again, for many, many years down in Southwest Virginia. and we'll continue to do so.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for your call and your question. Our next caller is Judy in Goochland County. Judy, welcome to Assembly Conversations. You're on with Governor Bob McDonnell.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Judy.
Calling on behalf of Virginia seniors, and with the influx of the seniors and disabled individuals, especially with dementia, wanted to find out the status of the signature for the Alzheimer's assisted living waiver. I know that that's been waiting for your signature for over 150 days, I think, and that had been talked about and discussed with various regulatory and advocacy groups. It would be a great way to increase the resources available for the Alzheimer's residents. So what do you see as the next step for that?
Well, Judy, let me thank you for your call. Let me correct you just on one thing. I mean, I signed that bill last year after I made some amendments back in March of last year. The board was in the process of looking at promulgating the regulations pursuant to the statute and was advised, I believe, by the Attorney General that they did not have the direct authority and there needs to be a statutory change that was made. So to my knowledge and talking to some of the patrons just in this last week, that bill has been put in to correct the statutory language to clarify that the board can promulgate these new regulations to license the people that will provide the services to Did you say Alzheimer's or autism?
It was Alzheimer's.
Okay, I'm sorry. I completely was going down the wrong track. I apologize completely. I was talking about the autism legislation. Judy. I don't know that I am aware of any delays in anything that is in our office regarding Alzheimer's regulations or legislation. So perhaps something that we can look into. I can only tell you it's something that I'm personally sympathetic to. I lost my father just a little over a year ago. He suffered with Alzheimer's for about 12 years and understand fully the challenges of being a caretaker or a relative of a person with Alzheimer's. And so I will, when we go back to the office, we'll certainly take a look at that. But I'm not aware there's any 150-day holdup at all in our office.
Thank you. Thank you, Judy. Thanks for your call and your question. Governor, our time is up for the edition of Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Thank you for coming on the program, Governor, with us.
Thank you, Bob.
It's good to have you back. I'd like to thank Fred Eccles, Jerry Caldwell, and Charlie Perkinson for engineering back at WVTF in Roanoke. And next week, join us in Assembly Conversations for a program on the effective use of state government and its relationship with local government, cities, and counties. I'm your host, Bob Gibson of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at UVA, saying thanks for joining us.
Assembly Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.